a scary place. I knew about the holes in the desert, of course, and everywhere I looked, there could have been a hole.
Have you had any bitch left?
It doesn't work for me. I gotta have more cowbell.
Your balls are showing.
Thank you for pressing the self-destruct button.
Maniac is imminent. Request advice.
With a firm tone of voice, demands Maniac lie down, hands behind back.
Well, that was a nice move, dumbass.
Marsha, Marsha, Marsha!
I got news for you, pal. You ain't leading but two things right now. Jack and shit. Jack left town.
I always say if you don't feel like a pervert, you ought to act like one.
Upload everything. I want to get it all on the internet tonight.
This is my boomstick! The 12-gauge double-barreled Remington. S-marked top of the line. Find this in the sporting goods department. That's right, this sweet baby was made in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Retails for about $109.95. Got a walnut stock, cobalt blue steel, and a hair trigger.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
You got one person online, the workload is enough for like 10 users. I think we got a hacker.
I want to get online. I need it. I'm coming for Scooter.
I can carry nearly 80 gigs of data in my head. Implant. Wet wire. I had to dump a chunk of long-term memory.
Did you bring me a monkey?
Leroy Jenkins!
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
Warning, Spankwagon Radio is now on the air.
It's...
Spankwagon Radio.
Oh, shit!
You know, sometimes when things just don't seem to go right, you have to do things a little differently to get through and to get the show on the road. Hello, everybody. It's Friday night. You are listening to the greatest internet radio show ever. You are listening to Spankwagon Radio. Now, for everybody wondering what the hell is going on, well, let me just tell you first off, I'm obviously not in studio. That would be kind of nice. Right now, what we're doing is we're trying to figure out what the hell is, where the hell is Claude Balls? Now, everybody, real quick, what we're going to do is we're going to take a little trip. This is a nice little trek, a little side trip. I hope everybody can hear me, and if you can't, oh well. Now, we're in the studio. Right now, I'm looking around the studio, and as a matter of fact, let me get the camera going on in the studio. Let's see. There's no Claude there. And by the way, if anybody's really cool, you're going to spankwagon.net. You're clicking on the cam chat link. You're chatting with us live, and you're watching the webcam, because what we're doing is we're going to go try to fight Claude. Too bad I can't take the camera with me. Hello, everybody out there. Can see me in the cam. There. Okay, so we know that Claude is not in the studio. So there we go. What we're going to do is we're going to try to figure out where the hell Claude is. We may even decide to do the show. Oh, by the way, ooh, feedback. Can't stand in the green room and do this. At least I know I can hear myself, and that's a good sign. Right now, we're heading outside. We're outside now, outside of the studio, the LV Rocks. here in wonderful Ghettoville, Las Vegas. Let me just go ahead. Let me just do this. Let me ask the engineer. Now, we're trying to find Claude Balls. We're actually on the air calling into our own patch. Have you seen Claude Balls?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so we now have no eyewitnesses for Claude Balls. And we don't know where he is. So we're going to keep looking. As a matter of fact, we're really not going to go too far out of the compound. We're going to check around the ghetto cars. And when I say ghetto cars, Claude and I talk about these cars way too often. He's not here. I don't know where he is. But we're going to go ahead, and when we know he's here, we're going to assault him. We're going to harass him. We're going to do everything we can to make sure he knows that we do miss him when 7 o'clock Las Vegas time rolls around. Right now, I'm walking back upstairs. I don't know if you can hear it. Police sirens and stuff. I wonder if they have Claude. There's a helicopter. If you can hear that. No, Claude Balls. Very, very confusing. Anywho, hope everybody's doing okay. It is Friday night. You're listening to Spank Wagon Radio. You can find us online, spankwagon.net. And Virgil 1 in the chat room, because I'm back upstairs now, is, we need the Claude cam. Yes, we do. We definitely need a wireless webcam. One of those X10 things. So, and of course, everybody's asking, what the fuck? So, yes. I'm your wonderful host, Trencher, trying to go play Where the Fuck is Claude Balls? And I don't think I'm going to get very far with this, because if you leave, like, the little compound here, and the Oldie Rock Studio is in a compound, very secure, very safe, razor wire. I feel just as safe and secure as a prisoner at Auschwitz. I know that if you use one of the bathrooms downstairs where the bums are broken into, it is a gas chamber. So, you know, warm, cozy feeling. Very Jewish 1945. Anyhow, back inside. Maybe I should get back to a normal microphone and start the show off properly. That'd be a good idea, wouldn't you think? Let's take a look here. Back in the studio. Let me turn on my mic and talk to you guys later.
All right. Yeah, we don't know where Claude Balls is. He gave me a call. Said something to the effect of, hello. Can't hear myself. Can you hear me? Ah, there I am. See what happens when I decide to fuck around a little and not start the show like a normal show should be started. Anywho. Ladies and gentlemen, Friday night, you're listening to Spank Wagon Radio. If I haven't said it enough, I'll say it again. You're listening to Spank Wagon Radio. Find us online, spankwagon.net. I'm your host, Trencher. Actually, all joking aside, Claude called me. He actually has our guest, so if you've been going to the website, you know who our guest is. Well, I don't know if the guest made Claude later, if Claude made the guest later, how this is working out, but we're here. We're definitely here. A little bit of things to cover. Hello, I got people walking in. I've got Trekkies walking into my green room. I've got all kinds of them walking into my green room. This... Claude! What's going on? Apparently. So we actually, Claude just made it in. Yeah, okay. Okay, we got the right camera on, so. You know, we were doing a little cruising around the neighborhood looking for you, doing a phone in.
Where are you now?
It got everybody's attention. Now everybody's talking about how we need to invest in wireless video cameras and stuff of that nature.
It's a very TV reality show. I'm not sure I like that.
What do you mean? Like, well, it's not like I have a crew following me. I only have the phone, okay? And maybe one camera.
That's right, because you're so paranoid about that, you didn't even like to get a cell phone in the first place.
No, I didn't, actually. I hate them. I still hate them. You know why I hate them? Michelle just lost yet another one that we just replaced 2 weeks ago.
So you hate cell phones because of that. I didn't see you hating cell phones that night. Your 73 Plymouth Duster started going dim.
Well, no. No, that's because where we were, the payphones were not very friendly.
What do you mean not very friendly? Like,
well,
come on.
We were in
sticky
the ghetto.
Buttons or what?
Well, that may be.
We were not in the ghetto.
What would you call it?
A sub-ghetto? The poor white trash section of town.
A poor white trash section of town.
That's right.
Do you even know what a ghetto means?
Yes, I do.
What does it mean?
There's a song about this.
Oh,
it's
no.
Like, it's G-H-E-T-T. It's an R&B song.
No, what?
It's a poor section of town.
A ghetto is not a poor section of town.
Yes, it is.
A ghetto is a neighborhood of a specific neighborhood of a specific
of poor
race.
People.
No, it's not poor people at all.
If you drive,
it could be about you could literally have a geek ghetto because it's all
geek ghetto.
Yes, absolutely.
Geeks would
look
not live in a ghetto.
Look, you got a computer.
What kind of geek?
Look at a computer. You
what
got,
kind of ghetto are we talking about, dude?
A ghetto.
A geek ghetto. So what? There's
do
like.
Do you own a dictionary?
Yes, I own a dictionary. Matter of fact, I even have a dictionary
here.
Widget.
Here. Oh, a widget. So, where is your laptop? Oh, yes, you have your laptop.
Of course I have my laptop.
Oh, God, apples everywhere. Holy cow. All right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to go to dictionary.com.
Ghetto is where poor people live.
Ghetto is not poor. Ghetto does not mean poor.
How come no one refers to Beverly Hills as a rich person's ghetto?
Okay. A section of city occupied by a minority group who live there especially because of social, economic, or legal pressure. Now, nowhere does that say poor. Nowhere. That's dictionary.
So you're telling me Bel Air is a ghetto for affluent people?
If you're using it in the true sense of the word, absolutely.
That's a fucking cop-out.
Cop-out my ass.
So basically you're trying to figure out a way to make poor people feel better about their plight in life.
And then there's something wrong with this?
No. It's political pressure. It's not the fact you're too lazy or you keep breeding kids.
What if it's an... Okay, so you're telling me that political pressure doesn't make reservations. As in Indian reservations,
political
not
pressure.
To dinner.
Indians don't live in ghettos. They live on reservations.
Oh, but that's an economic situation, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so that could fall under the term ghetto, right?
No, ghettos are comprised of buildings.
They farm dirt. That's all
Indians
they got on those
farm.
Reservations.
Indians don't farm nothing. They wait for the government checks to drink firewater.
I'm just saying.
I don't know what kind of goddamn after-school specials you've been watching.
Really, really badly produced ones by ABC Television. You know, the one with the gumball machine. The one I'm sure you have dozens of sound effects. Why are you bothering them now? We can wait a minute.
No way.
All of a sudden, zap, the board goes dead.
Everyone will get the ding of me checking my mail again.
Yeah, that's great. Your chat pops up, and all of a sudden, boom. Do we? At least you booted up first. That's a nice pleasant surprise. Didn't have to hear the bong. Boom. How you doing?
How's everybody doing tonight?
Actually, I don't know what mics
turn their mics
on.
Just turn it all on.
Just hit all the buttons. Every button's on. Okay. So you might have to flip the switch up atop there. In studio with us, someone generated some noise.
My bad.
That one off. We'll turn that one off.
I was off the premix.
We'll turn that off, too.
You go ahead and let's see if we get a caller. 1-866-LV-ROCKS, Las Vegas Locals, 3320, because we're too cheap to pay for the long distance.
3380120.
3380120, that's what
yeah,
I said.
Okay, just making sure. Got to keep on check. How's it going?
Good.
Keep me in check. You need a hearing aid.
Just come up to the mic a little more so we can hear you.
Okay. We're on here?
You're not. Now you are. Excellent. Now you're not. Now you are.
Excellent.
With us in studio, as if anybody who maybe read the website knows. What is that clipping noise?
I have no idea.
Well, now we start turning off.
Oops.
Was that you? Again?
No. It couldn't have been me.
No. With us in studio, as we're trying to say before Claude decides to make more noise, Dr. Bob is back. Everybody's favorite guy who knows molds, spores, and fun guys.
It's been a growing year.
It's been a growing year, has it?
Yes.
Now, I'm sure that was a pun, and I just missed it.
More than likely, you are dense.
Well, you know.
Let me see here if I can find that.
Well,
looking for sound effects.
You'll have to excuse
Spotlight
him.
Spotlight is not quick enough for me.
He decided that he wants to now set up for the show, and it's 15 after.
Oh, well, you know, we corrupted him beforehand.
Oh, that's good.
Yes. So I've downed an entire warp core breach.
Yes. Oh, no.
Yeah.
We're going to have drunk Claude by the second hour of the show. Man. He's going to be like, oh.
Now, this will be a very special episode tonight.
Well, we were telling an Andrew Dice Clay jokes from last night.
Ah.
Oops. Guess I got that volume up a little high. Let's go ahead. Let's readjust that.
Oh dear.
Okay,
God.
So now we were talking about this earlier. Now you have a book out about mold and spore standards, specifically like black mold and things like that.
Yes.
Well, and you said there's no regulation for those in the United States.
Yes, the United States is really about 15 to 20 years behind the rest of the world in this area. And we decided to educate this country and published a book called Worldwide Mold Exposure Standards. And you can find it on the web. And what's, I guess, is somewhat surprising is if someone does go to Google and does a mold exposure standard search, you'll see a number of websites on there that says there are no standards. Yet, all throughout Europe, Russia, China, the Far East, all of these countries have mold exposure standards, and they're not telling the people in this country about it.
Okay, now you're mentioning, you say mold exposure standards. We're talking about everything. I mean, everything under the sun, from stuff that you use to bake with the yeast to, you know.
Well, we're dealing mainly with the issue of abnormal growth of mold and fungi in people's homes. If you have a water leak, you get this black stuff growing in your home, underneath your kitchen sink, in your basement.
Mm-hmm.
And some people develop health problems as a result of that. Right. Or if you're buying real estate, you want to make sure that you're not buying a home that's got a severe water history.
Now, that's something I'm kind of curious about as well. There was an instance out here where people were two people that were signed into a tract home, completely different people, with two separate, completely different homes. Now, they were going to buy a brand new home. I believe the builder was Kaufman Broad. I could be mistaken on that. But what had happened is they complained that they had seen mold on the materials that were going up, the lumber. And they had made a complaint against this and were inquiring several times again and again, you know, will this be fixed? Is there a hazard? But specifically, they wanted this cleaned off before the home went up. And even after the builder told them that, you know, this is no problem, it's been exposed to the sun, the builder ended up, for fear of a lawsuit, terminating their escrow and would not sell to them.
Yes. Yeah, there is.
Now, is that true? If, you know, if there's simply a little bit of mold on a 2x4 that's going into a house to build a joist or a beam, is that any concern if it's been exposed to the sun and it's already dead?
It's not a concern whatsoever. There is a problem, particularly out west here in the Pacific Northwest, that mold is not dried like it was many years ago. Kiln-drying lumber is actually difficult to find these days. So you get lumber that's only partially dried, and as a result, during its storage period, it tends to grow some surface mold. But once the lumber is put up and allowed to dry, then that mold goes back to an inactive form and really presents no real health hazard or decay issue relative to the structure.
Really?
But people have been keyed into, oh my God, mold, I'm going to die type of stuff. And so they're abnormally reacting to a situation that poses no risk to them. Now, there's the one thing if you're dealing with mold that will grow within the human body. There's another thing when you're dealing with mold that normally grows on wood. You know, if we were Pinocchio, this might be an issue.
Right. Now, actually, it's very interesting. I almost wish that my wife was listening in today because she actually had a problem at her old school where mold would constantly grow on cinder blocks. It would rain and it would pour down the wall.
Yes.
Mold would grow in its place. Then the next day later.
Right.
And I love our wonderful school district solution.
Hmm.
Paint.
Well, you know, this is the same school district that found 14 rats in a cafeteria last week and claimed that there is no problem at all.
Yes, but the teachers are now striking back, or striking in a way.
On their lunch break.
By going on their lunch break outside with signs stating, you know, it's unhealthy for me, it's unhealthy for your kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the oldest middle schools that we have here in the Las Vegas Valley. Actually, I think it's the oldest
John C. Fremont Middle School, yes.
The oldest middle school here in Las Vegas.
Should I really be afraid of mold at all? I mean, because like I say, typically, if the media tries to cover it up, then I'm scared. But if they're blowing it out of proportion, I'm usually not too worried. I mean, these people that are like suing for millions of dollars, is this to actually recover costs because their health is being threatened and the home is a complete loss? Or are they just, for lack of a better word, pussies?
They're being panicked
okay.
by the media.
Okay.
Yeah, the real situation is if you are immunocompromised, if you have AIDS, mm-hmm. if you are taking prednisone or other steroid drugs, if you are undergoing chemotherapy, if you have cystic fibrosis, any type of disease that compromises your immunity system, then mold presents a particular health problem. But for the average person, the worst thing mold does is cause allergy symptoms.
Really?
Okay.
Yes. So it really is way blown out of proportion.
Okay, so it's really dependent on the person.
If it causes just allergy, why the book? I mean, if it's... Is it pandering to that panic, or is it trying to alleviate the panic?
It's trying to alleviate the panic. The problem is there are people out there who go, oh, my God, look at the black stuff in your bathroom. Mm-hmm. We have to totally rip out your bathroom and
which
rebuild
is common
it for $80,000.
Yeah, it's
which
very
is
common
big
here.
Very
and I have
common
a question
here.
About that, and you would be the guy to ask about this. This seems to be something more recent in the last few years. Is there like a problem with gypsum being more of a better petri dish for it rather than old-fashioned plaster?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Gypsum is what we call an industry mold candy. Mm-hmm. It's mold likes to eat cellulose, mm-hmm. Okay, or something like that. So what you have in gypsum is partially digested paper, which is cellulose.
Right.
So
right.
It's like mold candy. You throw a little water on it, and boom, mold starts growing. Now, interestingly enough, when you get that brand new sheet of drywall,
right.
That solution that was laminating the paper on already contains spores that will initiate growth just giving the water. It isn't just a situation of, okay, I've got to get it wet, and then you got to get spores on it. It's already pre-indoctrinated to grow mold.
Really?
So you throw the water on it, and boom, it grows.
That's very interesting right there. That really does answer a lot of questions, such as, you know, places like in New Orleans, which we'll talk about a little bit later. We'll touch on that. Mm-hmm. You know, where all of a sudden people, you know, in the past, someone has just had, you know, regular plaster, you know, that they've thrown up inside of a room and everything's fine, even after flood damage, which is interesting, too, you know, touching on something else, you know, why homes now are only rated for 50 years when in places such as, you know, Los Angeles and even Chicago, where you're from, you've had homes that are like century or more old,
you know,
older,
fact,
and they're fine living.
And then one of the funny things is actually I'll go online to look at houses in the Midwest where I'm from, and I'll see a house that was built in like 1893. I'm going, now that can still stand. How come my house that I just bought
right.
4 years ago now it has only 48 years left on it, you know?
Right. What's interesting about plaster is a caustic substance. It's mm-hmm. it's basically calcium oxide. And when it gets wet, its pH rises to roughly 13. As long as it's above 8, it will no longer support mold growth.
That's pretty high, 13.
Yeah, it's a material that inhibits mold growth once it becomes wet. And this is not new. The Romans knew about this. How do you think Romans invented concrete that hardens underwater?
Mm-hmm.
Rome, the artisans of Rome made Venice possible. The foundations within a majority of buildings in Venice were actually poured using Roman concrete.
It's very interesting.
So this is not new stuff. The Romans knew about it. There's a Roman architect that has written many, many books, and if you go to architecture school, you'll probably see some of them. And he discusses mold in homes and how to prevent it. And I guess what's most interesting, he says, put gutters on homes to make sure the water goes away.
Right.
And if you're going to use a wood beam, make sure if it's going to get wet, you make it so it's easy to remove the wood beam mm-hmm. when the thing rots. Now we're talking roughly 300 AD to 400 BC when these books were written.
Wow.
You know, what, did we forget about this? Well, you know, hey, Romans knew about
well,
this.
Well, no, it's not anybody forgot. It's... let's build the houses a little cheaper.
Yes.
Let's
right.
build them a little closer together.
See, that's very
let's
rare
change...
to find in Las Vegas is a home with gutters.
Yes. Let's change the grade of the land so that way water does not drain naturally. And let's block everybody in so you have one place that the water leaves and totally just jams up because trash gets in the way.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting, funny story. In 2000, there were massive floods in Czechoslovakia.
Right.
Because of the weather uniqueness. Mm-hmm. So the United States hygienists, these people who claim to deal with mold, mm-hmm. call up Czechoslovakia and go, oh, we can give you all kinds of help. And Czechoslovakia goes, well, you know what, guys? We have plaster, so we don't have a problem.
Right.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, okay, it floods, not a big deal. And interesting enough, the same thing in Germany, the same thing in Poland, and even in Colombia, they use plaster. And where'd they learn that from? From the Spanish conquistadors. Mm. If you ever go to South America or Cuba or Puerto Rico,
mm-hmm.
what did you have? You had a brick structure where they put plaster on it because in those climates you run near 100% humidity.
Right.
Right, anything
right.
but plaster, you're going
to
grow stuff.
You know, a few years ago to my trip to Rome, I mean, Italy and Naples, I mean, right there on the sea.
And you've been there. You were.
Yeah, and it's all concrete. It's all, you know, pavement. I mean, it's all houses are not built out of wood. Houses are slowly built out of concrete. I mean, that's just the way it is.
That's very interesting. And the same thing we're talking about is you stayed in a home of someone that was probably, you know, eons old practically.
Right. Let's do this really quick. People in chat are asking the doctor of. Because I know he's Dr. Bob, but okay. You know, it's been about a year now.
It's occupational and safety and health, dealing with the environment and safety regulations to protect people and the environment. My master's degree is in public health, so I deal with the disease issue. And my bachelor's is in environmental and thermomechanical engineering, so I understand how homes and structures are built together and how they operate from an energy transfer point of view.
Very
and you
interesting.
You combine all that expertise and you understand why mold grows within the structure.
Now, just out of curiosity right here, and if you were to, you know, you've written the book right now, if it were to be adopted and acknowledged by many industry people, I'm sure you could write a book on what to look for even. You know, if buying a home, if I were to go in to look at either a brand new or even a used home, where should I look and what should I look for to see if I'm looking at a home that's susceptible to mold?
Yeah, the first place to look is if it's got a crawl space. You know, how was the home built on top of the soil?
Mm-hmm.
What most people are unaware of is soil transfers water into your home.
Mm-hmm.
It just, if it mm-hmm. didn't, we wouldn't be able to grow trees or grass.
Right,
so
right, right.
How your home is built on the soil is really important to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's no plastic in your crawl space or anything to stop that water transfer will get into your joists and eventually mm-hmm. cause microbial amplification within your crawl space.
So what about instead of if you don't have a crawl space, which most Las Vegas homes don't, they're actually
right.
built on post-tension slabs.
Right. That is called slab-on-grade. Construction,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You still get water transfer. And where you run into an issue there is if you put carpeting on that floor,
mm-hmm.
and the carpeting, of course, eventually gets dirty,
mm-hmm.
and you get sufficient water transfer, that will start mold and bacterial growth within your carpeting.
Right.
And you get that, you walk into a house, and it's got an odor.
Yeah, it's got that old smell or
right.
mold.
I figured that was
mold.
With the previous tenants.
That's what's growing in your
carpeting.
It
may have been if they didn't clean.
Yes.
When I lived next to a meth lab, yes.
No, that was a smell all uniquely its own.
Yes.
People flushing toilets all night, having parties, and my house smelling like Clorox. And stealing my electricity, I'm sure. Since it doubled as soon as I moved in. But, yeah. See, like I say, I'm just kind of curious about that. Is there anything I should look for other than maybe an odor? Is there any particular place, like, for instance, I mean, obviously I'd look underneath a cabinet in the kitchen because, you know, for an ice maker, line that might be there presently and look for water under cabinets. Is there anything else I could look for a telltale sign?
Yeah, the typical places where water leaks occur are underneath your kitchen sink, underneath your bathroom, toilet drains leak, showers leak. So if you're looking at
any plumbing really is prone to leaking. I mean,
well, see, plumbing is one thing too, but you know, we mentioned gutters and sufficient drain off. Now here in Las Vegas, you have one of these houses with the air conditioning heating, the HVAC unit is actually on top of your home.
On the roof, yes.
And you actually probably have that, tar paper, so everything drains mm-hmm. off the condensation.
It all drains off to the east side of my house, and it drains about a foot away from my house during the summer
mm-hmm.
In a puddle. Interesting problem I experienced with that is ants need moisture. They want moisture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had fire ants discover that water was there, and they started scaling the side of my house trying to find the water, which also on that side of my house is my shower. So I had ants finding water and heading straight into my shower.
Very interesting.
So,
but like I say, should there be anything I check for up there? Should I actually take the time to go into an attic crawl space? Because people don't do that. They rely on, the appraiser and the home inspector to do these things.
Well, if you look at the ceiling below a bathroom and you mm-hmm. see it's recently been painted, that's a red flag.
Same really?
Thing, yes. Same thing below an attic or in a ceiling in a bedroom that's recently been painted. There may be covering up a roof leak or a water leak.
Hmm.
So you need to look for that, those issues of why did they clean the stuff up or if the plaster's been patched.
Mm-hmm.
Other places to look have to do with the outside. If you see peeling paint in this climate, in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
you have a water problem in the building because paint only peels because there's water pressure pushing the paint off
right.
the structure.
Right, right. Hmm. Because most paints, even the latex, any paint, if you're going to put enough water through that, I mean, it's
right.
flowing down or flowing out, it's going to bubble and strip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Right. And the other, in this particular climate, you have a lot of people who put up concrete walls.
Right.
Concrete block walls separating properties. And you'll notice kind of a white, fuzzy...
Definitely. Landscaping system spraying
right,
water.
It's called efflorescence.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see that in a concrete block wall in a foundation or something like that in a building, that means you have water entering that wall. So if you see efflorescence or that white powder on a wall inside of a home, you have a water problem.
Really? So we should look for scale along the outside of a house there
That's
as well.
Correct. Yes.
Hmm. That's very, very interesting.
Well, what we're going to do right now, we need to cut to our first break. You're listening to the greatest internet radio show ever.
Spankwagon Radio. And you know what? I'll hit the music for this one.
Are you sure you got it? Because I got it ready to go. I got it ready to go.
You sure
you
got
it?
So what
we're going to do, Dr. Bob's going to stay with us along with the truckers there.
And we have more stuff to talk about
as well.
More
stuff, because as everybody remembers from the last time, we've got conspiracy theories and... You know, we've got tons of political speak because of last week's request.
Most definitely. The
some
listeners
good stuff. Some good stuff from
political.
Our mayor. We'll get a definite. It'll be nice to hear some outside opinion on our mayor.
And you know what? You're a college student. You could appreciate this. Dr. Bob's son here actually has some developed a new piece of software I think even you could use.
Very cool. So we'll be back in a little bit. You're listening to?
You are listening to Spankwagon Radio.
Silence! For some place to host your website, or maybe you already have a host and are looking for a better deal, then check out AnywhereHost.com. AnywhereHost.com offers 24/7 live technical support, a 99.99% network availability guarantee, and with packages starting as low as under $10 a month, you can see why hundreds are making the move to AnywhereHost.com. Visit the website for all the hosting packages available at AnywhereHost.com or call toll-free at 1-888-863-4383. That's 1-888-863-4383.
Alrighty, we are back. You're listening to the greatest internet radio show ever,
Spank Wagon Radio.
I'm your host, Trencher.
I, of course, am the infallible Buck 50 Sugar Daddy, Claude Balls.
And with us, of course, is Dr. Bomb.
Yeah, we're back.
We're back. And, of course, guess, because I can still not remember your name, and I knew... Okay, why don't we try that with the mic? With the mic.
This is test.
There we go.
Do you get him? Okay.
Yeah, I can hear him fine.
We'll figure this out later.
Now, that's something very interesting before we go on right now. There's something a little odd right
actually,
here.
Really quick before we do anything else, I want to point out, check us out online, spankwagon.net.
Plug.
Also, you can give us a call at
1-866-LV-ROCKS, Las Vegas Locals, 383-8120.
So if you want to talk to the doctor, have any questions, and we'll get into a little bit interestingly different stuff here in a little bit.
Indeed.
Yes, and we'll start talking about software here in a little bit as well.
But I was going to point something out. It's very interesting.
Yes.
Well, a lot of people don't actually realize this. We are in a room of 5 people right now.
Yes.
And we have 3 DeLorean owners in here.
Yes.
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 This is true.
Four. Do you have your own one now?
Yeah.
So we have 4 DeLoreaners out of 5.
Crap.
And I noticed something, too. You have a tattoo of a DeLorean on your ankle.
I'm still not going to get a DeLorean. I may get a Bricklin down the road. We never know.
I noticed that right there. I got to be iconoclastic in some way, you know. Yeah. I was actually going to get one tattoo on my back or arm of my VIN number.
Oh, that's cool.
Yes.
You got to do it.
See, you like the Gull Wings, too, man, but you can't bring yourself to own the DeLorean.
No, I can't bring myself to own something that someone else already has because, you know, I don't know, just something about that.
When are you going to get the Bricklin?
Find me a good one that isn't going to fall apart.
I can find you plenty of good ones. You found a great one.
One that doesn't have, we don't know what we painted it with. Ah, crap.
A DeLorean is not a Me Too car. So even if your friends have them, you know, you can customize it and make it unique to your own.
That is true. That is very true.
And, you know, we actually have 4 DeLorean owners in here right now. You know, there's one thing that actually has been said, quick segue on this. Why did you buy them?
Because I didn't want a Me Too car. and secondly, I couldn't afford a 300 SL. But you know what's interesting? I know a couple of people who own the Mercedes Gullwings, and the windows don't work. There's no air conditioning. The husbands buy the car. The wives absolutely hate them. Now, it's okay. This is Germany. It's cooler. You drive that in the summertime in the United States, you die in that car.
It's going to be pretty intense. It's like trying to drive a movie car around. You know, there may be a blower motor in there if you're lucky, but otherwise it's for show, not function.
Right. It's a mule. That's all it is.
Pretty much. Now, why did you decide to get one?
Well,
you're actually second generation at this point.
Yeah, I am. But I believe the DeLorean to be a far more ethical car.
Ethical?
A far more ethical car. And I've just started reading John DeLorean's book, On a Clear Day, You Can See General Motors. And he talks about the ethics of modern car manufacturing and how cars nowadays are designed to be disposable.
Well, I think that kind of goes back all the way to the 50s with the DeSoto. I mean, the DeSoto was one of those cars that was, you own one DeSoto, you continue to own one DeSoto,
you die
and give away your one DeSoto. I mean, that's how it worked. They went, you know, making us a lot of money.
I even asked that same question. That's the same night I insulted the DeLorean engineer with my foolhardy questions of, was there no planning ahead for repeat customers, and why did you not put a cup holder in my car, you bastard?
The cup holders.
Yes, I actually got a chance to meet with Bill Collins. If you're DeLorean, or you know who this person is, and I asked him why he didn't bother to put a cup holder in my car. He was three sheets to the wind, sucking down gin and tonic all night. It was not prepared for my question. So you bought one because you like what it represents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it represents an era where the cars could last 25 years or longer. John DeLorean was going to warranty his cars for 25 years.
Right.
And that would have destroyed Corvette if he had stayed in business.
There is a good point. Now, you as well. Now, this is something rare to find as well, not just a female DeLorean owner, but someone who purchases an exotic car. Why did you buy
one? Someone who absolutely doesn't want a microphone turned on them whatsoever.
Talk about Back to the Future.
No.
Hold on. Let's aim the webcam, too.
Aim the webcam.
No.
You had the hottest car in high school. Let's admit it.
You had one in high school?
You had a DeLorean in high school.
I've had a DeLorean since I was 15.
Wow, impressive.
One of the youngest DeLorean owners in existence.
Yes.
I've heard that line before, about a year ago.
So why did you buy one? Did you just like Back to the Future, thought it was cool? Or?
Yeah, I love Back to the Future.
I've been in arguments about temporal displacement with people on the web and decided to almost shoot myself one time, but... Yeah, I know. You know what?
Better luck next time.
Thank you. Thank you. Wish me well. Even though we'll see if I make it another year because it is technically my birthday today.
Woohoo! Wow. Congratulations.
Happy birthday. Yes, thank you. Please send all donations to DMC Vegas at Cox.net through PayPal. Thank you. I'm not giving out my checking account number, dude. Not even if you do know some rich Nigerian that just died. But so that's very interesting right there because there usually seems to be some sort of different reason for everybody. And it's very it's actually very generational. It seems that younger people did actually get recognition of the car through Back to the Future.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very interesting, too, because most time a lot of the older generation of people don't actually like them because, the whole scandal that went on. And because when you are, someone who's all about image, what they cost, and you don't want something that reflects, you only had that much amount of money. And it's very interesting too, talking with a lot of people actually at DeLorean Motor Company, they said their young clientele of owners simply don't give a damn. And a lot of articles have been written about that to say people who drive DeLoreans, are they really just cheap or are they actually flaunting something that no one else has, a sense of independence?
Well, I saw an article in one of John DeLorean's obituaries. He says, in order to own a DeLorean, it helps to have an ego the size of a house.
That is true. You cannot be a
humble DeLorean owner.
Hold on while that sinks in.
Hey, I'm as humble as the next guy.
But
there is no next guy.
I think about it as the poor man's Lamborghini.
The poor man's Lamborghini.
Another
car that shares K-Jetronic fuel injection.
I don't like that statement.
You don't like that
statement. I don't like that statement at all, and I'll tell you why. One, looking at Lamborghinis, and for years always having
For someone who doesn't own one, you're kind of defensive.
Hold on. No, and will you shut up and let me finish what I'm going to say? I wouldn't even put them in the same market because I don't even think Lamborghinis are that great of a car. Yeah, that one's dead mic. Don't ask. I don't
know.
Playing
musical chairs with microphones here. We don't know what they're doing in their spare time. But you were saying you don't like the term poor man's Lamborghini.
I don't like it because I don't like Lamborghinis.
You don't like Lamborghinis.
I don't think Lamborghinis are that great of a car. I mean, as we've seen and as I've read, and everybody has the posters of Lamborghinis and stuff like that, and I'm not a huge fan of them. I mean, the jackknife doors, something unique. The really square, not squared, but the really, angular look.
Been in a Lamborghini?
Thankfully, no. Because I've heard. Now, and I will admit, all my information is really third hand. Like, if you watch Top Gear, it's a British-run show. One of the guys drives a Lamborghini for a full day. It's his dream car. He's always wanted to drive a Lamborghini. It was a Countach, I believe. He smelled like gas by the end of the day. It had no air circulation. It was really hard to drive. The understeer, oversteer were all horrible. It wasn't a fun car. Mm-hmm. Now, I know from riding with Claude, and actually the one time I did drive his car, miracles will never cease. It was
the only person outside of my family that's ever driven that car after I owned it.
It was comfortable. It was.
You fell asleep in my car in the passenger seat.
Your seats are, man. I can fall asleep anywhere though.
They're comfy cars, man.
Dude, I could fall asleep here if I just put my head down on the mic. Yeah.
Well, a Lamborghini is an extremely noisy car. It has
it rattles.
The average noise level is like 92 decibels, which if you were in there for 8 hours, that'll damage your hearing.
Yes, it will. One thing just to point out, Lamborghinis were owned by Chrysler. Lamborghini was owned by Chrysler in the mid-'80s.
Because you're a big Mopar guy.
I'm a huge Mopar guy. And I totally believe one of the reasons they purchased Lamborghini was so they could have a cool car that squeaked.
A cool car that squeaked.
It's the only reason I think they bought it. That's Iacocca. Yeah. Oh, suspension? Any panel, it's worse than a Saturn.
Right. Now, you know what? I've shared this with a guest right there, but I've not actually had a chance to interact with any DeLorean owners. So, you know, this will be a good time to spread the word. Now, you're DeLorean owners, and you've heard the whole thing about how people have gotten locked inside the car doors, and that's urban legend. That's never actually happened.
That's correct.
I can tell you something right now, and Trencher was there with me. We went to the General Motors test drive, and you can share this with all your friends. Matter of fact, please, by all means, I encourage it. I was in a brand new 2006 Corvette C6, and I got locked inside of it.
Yes.
Yes. With the alarm going off.
With the alarm going off, because instead of having door latches on the doors, they're on the car, and the striker pins are on the doors. Mm-hmm. So it's a completely back-assward way of setting up a car door, and I got locked inside of a Corvette.
Yeah, well, like I said, while the alarm's going off, and your initial, I mean, we've talked about this on the show
My initial reaction being a DeLorean owner was to get up and kick the windshield out to get out of the car. Yeah. And I could not move. I was trapped inside of it. The steering column, it's actually motorized to be telescopic instead of having a,
mechanical.
Instead of having a screw to lock it down.
It is analog to Corvette trying to be digital.
I couldn't get the steering wheel to retract or anything, and even my size, I have no problem swapping seats inside of the car. I can slip over the center console from seat to seat, but I was trapped in the Corvette and couldn't get out. My first reaction, though, yes, was to get up on the center console and kick the windshield out.
How long did it take him to get you out of the car?
Until someone actually
disabled the alarm before he could even get out. So that means there are Corvette owners out there who... Yeah, everybody does this. Everybody who has an alarm. I've done it once. You know, they forget to disarm totally. They go in, they put the key in the ignition, bam-o, that alarm goes off. But in a Corvette, that locks you in there before you can fumble your keys. If you can't even move around to get your keys,
yeah, if you drop your keys in the other seat over there or something.
Didn't they make a movie like that where the car would, if you were trying to steal the car and you got trapped inside and it electrocuted you?
It wasn't like RoboCop, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what's very interesting is actually in South Africa, because carjackings are so rampant, they actually have one device was a flamethrower. It hasn't worked out too well to shoot up at an assailant. And the other one was actually I believe it was like a 2-inch thick steel bar that was spring-loaded. It would actually flip out and break the ankles of the carjacker.
Yeah, well, no, this is like a lot of aftermarket stuff, too.
This is not standard. This is aftermarket.
Yeah, Mercedes isn't going, maim your neighbors with this model. No, it's not doing that.
But no, like I say, I bought mine because I had seen one when I was a little kid. Barring Back to the Future, I never really kind of made the connection, but I saw one in the wild back in 89.
Quick question.
Don't know who the owner was, but...
Claude, hold on. Quick question from the chat room. Anorexic Pillow asks, these DeLoreans are nice. These? I guess he's looking at some. I would love one. How rare are they? Thank you. I'm getting help in my own chat room.
How many?
They made close to 8,500.
Actually, about 10,000 now is the current thing. New Grimsrud, who has been keeper of that, has actually been looking at VIN numbers, and they're saying actually they stopped keeping track, and it's actually closer to over 10,000 at this point.
Excellent. Yeah. And only 10% of those, or 1,000, were automatics. The rest were sticks.
And that's nice.
Automatics were not very common. And matter of fact,
but yet we know one guy who has one, or had one.
I've got an automatic. Hmm.
You've got an automatic?
They're far, far better and easier to drive than Tiffany's stick here.
Ooh, I want to argue that. I got to drive Stitt's immaculate automatic that was there, and I got to say the pickup was not there. I scared the hell out of him, though, when I slid it around a corner on the on-ramp and started taking it up onto 95.
You know what? Talking about like things like cutting off...
Matter of fact, you two were behind me on the way here, and you got to see how close I get to cars.
Try
riding with him, and I'm like, dude, break. You need to stop.
And number one, he needs fresh air to keep from getting car sick, and there's no oh shit bars.
Drifting is not a sport.
Well, yeah.
Yes, it is. Drifting, I have people argue that.
Drifting is survival on ice. Pure and simple. Hey, actually, a little bit of a news article here. Hearst has decided they're finally going to start making jaws of life that are safe to use
on hybrids. On hybrids. I heard about that.
Here, responding to the need to protect rescue workers from electrical dangers when extracting victims from hybrid electric vehicles, Hurst has introduced a new specialized tool, similar in power and construction to other popular Jaws of Life hydraulic spreaders and cutters. The new tool will actually have a unique electrical current insulation, providing extra safety from, you know, for rescuers when they're cutting through hybrid cars.
Right, because they've said that in hybrid cars, the power cords from the battery pack to the motor slash generator is enough electricity to kill rescue workers trying to rescue.
Oh, easily kill them.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's 500 volts compared to a 12, you know, normal cars have 12 volts. They have
500 volts.
Mm-hmm. 500 volts,
yeah. But with a pretty good dosage of amperage.
Well, yeah, you need a high current in a hybrid because you have to charge it up as you go, and you need that higher current.
Sure.
So something interesting here I thought we'd bring up since we're mentioning car stuff.
Yeah, the hybrids right there. I still think hybrids are a waste of time. I got to be honest. I think it's overpriced. I think if someone just simply empties their trunk and drives sensibly, I think we can get the gas mileage of a hybrid.
You know, and honestly, with you saying that, I mean, I even have a bunch of crap in my trunk. And I'm still getting 300 miles, a tank in my Neon. And that's all city driving.
Mm-hmm.
God forbid if I actually was able to drive anywhere outside of Vegas or had a need to, I would definitely get way more than 300 miles.
Well, mm-hmm. I think you got to look at the European continent where gasoline has been $4.50 or $5.50 a gallon for many years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They have not adopted hybrid technology.
No, they haven't.
They've learned how to drive. They drive smaller cars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes X amount of energy to go so far.
They also have a better infrastructure for, you know, public transportation.
Well, okay, better public transportation, but not only that, but think about how, you know, European cities were laid out back before, you know, the car was ever invented. So everything had to be pedestrian accessible. So that means towns, cities, villages, everything is more pedestrian accessible. They're able to do that. You know, United States, we were more or less developed really truly around the car. I mean, the car has been the centerpiece to the United States and to our economic well-being for so many years.
Pretty much. Los Angeles was the first place that developed around the car. More conspiracy theory fun right here, because General Motors actually bought out the public transportation service electric car, so they could push diesel.
Yeah, right. And you mentioned, you know, the fact that they do make the smaller cars. Well, I think a lot of it's actually necessity for location.
Mm-hmm.
You can't drive an American car comfortably in Europe under any circumstances.
On those small roads.
No, exactly. You can't. I when I've been over there, and you know, the smaller cars, you know, the smart cars, which are brilliant little cars.
Oh, those are great little cars.
Great little cars, but you
wait, which ones?
Smart. Yeah, whatever. You know, those cars, the different cars that, you know, Fiat, Seat, I'm trying to think of all the Opel makes. You know, I was driving around and in an American Saturn, because that's what they brought over when they went to work in the military over there in Europe. And that car was even just a tad almost too big for some of the places we had to go.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You know, you see whole families riding around on mopeds, though. There's other things going on there that dictate small cars are a necessity. You know, economics and everything.
Other than fuel consumption?
Other than fuel consumption. You're talking about countries that, while they are industrialized, they're not third world, but they have high, super high unemployment rates and super high poverty rates that you don't see.
Yep.
You know, because they do live differently. They are living in places older. They have a government infrastructure that does help them out somewhat.
Yeah. And they have their landlocked. They've been landlocked for many thousands of years. And it's nothing to see two generations living within the same house.
Mm-hmm.
And they are more environmentally conscious. And their climate allows them to ride mopeds a large percentage of the year, which we in many of our northern cities do not have that advantage.
No, you don't. But I've noticed that, you know, in places like Vegas, it's starting to grow.
Yes.
I don't know what it's like in Chicago. I really, you know, or even in the Midwest.
Vegas,
whatsoever.
We actually have a huge problem with unregistered mopeds and vehicles that are not allowed to be on the road. People driving these things back and forth to work.
Yeah.
Of course, they also have to compete with H2s out here a lot, so that makes it very interesting.
Speed bump.
If you're talking about Vegas, we talked to a few cabbies who say they're all on propane.
Yes, absolutely.
Compressed natural gas.
Yeah, so Vegas is in many ways a cornerstone of alternative fuels.
We're really not a cornerstone of alternative fuels.
I wouldn't say cornerstone. Not where California is going.
Matter of fact, right now we are running 90% capacity on the CalNev fuel line, which is what actually supplies us.
Isn't it the CalNev RE? Aren't we also in the Arizona?
Calnev is the one that is the primary supplier, but Calnevare is the corporation itself, which
got
also
it.
Supplies
okay,
Arizona.
Okay. I just want to make sure.
Right now, we have fuel pipelines coming mm-hmm. from the refineries in Signal Hill and Long Beach that feed Las Vegas instead of trucking the fuel.
Okay.
They're running 90% capacity, and it's estimated by 2012 we will have a fuel crisis in Las Vegas simply because we cannot deliver enough fuel here.
Yeah. Well, I think if we get rid of some of these 8,000-pound vehicles, you know, in terms of why we have so many large, inefficient vehicles today,
uh-huh.
is the air pollution regulations were written at the time that if you were exceeded a gross vehicle weight of 7,500 pounds, you were exempt from the standards.
Right.
Because at that point, only 10% of the car manufacturing output was small trucks.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of this changed, too, because what happened was people were using SUVs to get around this, and they pushed SUVs more to get away from the regulations. And what happened as well is because of the gross vehicle weight, I mean, the H2 itself has a 1,400-pound skid plate, and that was to push it over the edge
mm-hmm.
so it could be considered agriculture equipment so people could get discounts on these as company vehicles. And what happened is people like California put in regulations defining the difference between an SUV for passenger vehicle and a truck had to be open cargo space, hence the birth of the H2 open cargo, the H3 open cargo, and the Ford Explorer Sport Track. It's the same exact vehicle, but because they now sport open cargo space, they qualify for tax exemptions, and that's what the auto manufacturers have actually done to accommodate buyers.
So the net effect is they were producing vehicles with built-in inefficiencies to increase our fuel consumption.
Mm-hmm.
So whose interest were they working for? They were selling cars, they were making the environment worse, and they were increasing our dependence upon foreign oil, all of which are no good for anybody except for their bottom line.
Now, just to kind of play devil's advocate right here, I mean, were they really working towards the fuel companies, or was it just basic corporate laziness to cut costs to prevent research? Maybe, you know, fuel companies be damned.
Hey, really quick, before you answer that question, I want to point out, if anybody else has a question for Dr. Bob, 1-866-LV-ROCKS, that's 1-866-587-6257. Got to throw that out.
Thank you. I think we have to look at what R&D expenditures the U.S. automakers have put into from mm-hmm. Developing advanced engine technologies. And the reality is they've spent very little on research compared to what the Japanese have done.
Right.
And the Japanese have produced engines that are far more fuel efficient when you mm-hmm. look at what's called brake-specific fuel consumption.
Right.
So, and you'll
wait,
see.
Hold on. Wait, brake-specific fuel consumption? That's
right.
A new term to me.
I've
heard brake horsepower before.
No, brake-specific fuel consumption is the technical term for measuring the thermomechanical efficiency of an internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
And you what you do is you take an engine, you put gasoline into it, and you calculate how much fuel it uses per horsepower.
Right.
That's your and horsepower is measured on a dynamometer, and a dynamometer actually brakes an engine, and it adds friction, and that friction is called braking non-technically. So it's called brake-specific fuel consumption.
Interesting.
And typically an American car runs about, I believe it's 0.5 pounds of gasoline per horsepower in terms of a brake-specific fuel consumption,
mm-hmm.
and some of the much more efficient engines are down to around 0.3. You're talking a 40% reduction in fuel consumption for the same horsepower.
Now, can we get around that with better lubricants, or you know, or is that just engine design itself,
it's
the combustion chamber?
It's engine design. It deals with a concept. The stoichiometric ratio, which is the ideal concentration of burning fuel or gasoline in air, is around 14.5. 14.5 per issues of or volumes of air to one vaporized volume of gasoline.
Right.
However, you can reduce the concentration instead of 14.5 down to 18 up to 20 to 1 and still produce a flame front and efficient combustion.
Hmm.
So that's the concept of what's called a stratified charge engine. And now the Japanese are working on what you do is you put gasoline into a combustion chamber,
sure.
and right around the spark plug, you produce a fuel mixture of around 14.5, mm-hmm. and the rest of the chamber is filled 18 to 20 to 1. So the 14.5 starts the ignition and then burns the rest of it out. So you're cutting your fuel consumption by 30%, and you still...
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Something that actually started with the Honda CVCC engine.
That's correct.
Where they would actually, instead of making something that burn less fuel, they actually made it burn more efficiently inside the combustion chamber dealing with the intakes.
Yeah. So
now,
so
what about other technologies? I mean, I've heard a lot of things such as like Stirling engine. Smoky Eunuch wanted to have like an engine that ran like 1,000 degrees, and you know, it seems really kind of ludicrous. What about hydraulic drive engines? There's a term for this. This was brought up recently online about an engine where instead of actually being coupled directly to a transaxle, the engine does nothing more than run a hydraulic fluid pump, which then in turn spins a disc like a kind of like a
yeah,
like
you'll
a water mill.
Yeah, you'll right. find hydraulic drive on a lot of farm equipment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of energy losses in that mechanical to a fluid dry transfer. Interestingly, Ford developed some prototype hybrids where instead of running electrical, they ran compressed air. So during your braking, you would drive an axle which drove a compressor that produced compressed air into a cylinder, and during acceleration, you use that compressed air to drive the axle again. And it reduced fuel consumption about 10%. It was a lot cheaper, certainly a lot less complicated than an electrical system, but they have decided to not pursue it.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's, you know, regenerative braking and trying to recover that energy. There is some issues and uses in that. But it really comes down to if you can make an engine burn on a much leaner mixture, you can save a tremendous amount of fuel.
Right. And that's just kind of goes without saying.
Well, that's also complicated, too, because the more lean we get, the more nitrous oxide we kick out.
If you're looking at nitrous oxide emissions, if you push the air-to-fuel ratio around 15 to 16.5 to 1, you will increase your nitrous oxide emissions. But once you get into 18 to 20, the actual nitrous oxide emissions go down.
Really?
Yes.
Now, what about one of the claims recently that's come up by a few scientists saying that actually fuel-efficient cars such as Hondas are contributing to global warming because their catalytic converters are pumping out too much hydrogen? And an overabundance of hydrogen is actually a global warming gas.
Oh, I think that's kind of really misleading information. The whole concept of global warming is based upon the thing called a carbon balance, how much carbon we are adding to our environment. And all of the various forms of carbon compounds are all greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is you can temporarily measure something coming out of an exhaust pipe, but realize at some point it's going to react with other things in the atmosphere and end up producing an infrared absorbing compound.
Right.
So just because you're taking a bias and looking at it at the tailpipe, you really need to look at the bigger picture. And the fact is, if you're adding more carbon to the environment, you're increasing our global warming issue.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's very interesting right there, because I've heard a lot of things for and against, and pretty much now, right now, it seems to me the best way we have for fuel as it goes right now probably be our scaling back what kind of vehicles we need. I mean,
actually,
I got to be honest. I own a Ford Explorer. It's an SUV, and I love the feeling of owning it. I'm up higher, and granted, I know it's not as secure. Driving it, it goes without saying, I feel much more at risk. I will tell you right now, in comparison with just even my pickup truck, let alone my DeLorean to it, it feels like I'm riding a stack of books that's tipping over whenever I turn a corner.
Something to bring up, actually, with the greenhouse gases and you know, the carbon in the air. One study that's actually they're doing here in the deserts of Nevada, they're actually setting up a very controlled experiment where they're measuring how much carbon plants intake can, and then you know, turn out back to oxygen. And they're actually finding that plants are able to keep up with the more and more and more carbon that we're introducing to our air.
Yeah, there's some real interesting research in that area. Some of it goes back to the mid-70s, where they were looking at taking exhaust gases from power plants, pumping those into greenhouses, and accelerating the growth of vegetables and lettuce and whatever within a greenhouse.
Really?
Plants, from an evolutionary standpoint, have existed throughout history where carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere have been 4, 5, 6 times what they are today.
Mm-hmm.
Plants have the ability to significantly increase their metabolic rate and growth rate under elevated carbon dioxide conditions. Mm-hmm. So yes, there definitely is a dampening effect of adding, in other words, if we add more CO2 to the atmosphere, more stuff will be absorbed by the plants. The biggest problem within that is the largest carbon dioxide sink within vegetative matter on the planet is the Amazon, mm-hmm. and we're losing about 1,000 acres per day in the Amazon. So had we kept the Amazon the way it was and didn't allow all of this deforestation to take place, yes, plants would be adapting to this increased carbon dioxide level and metabolizing it. So we have a double effect going on in terms of not only just adding the stuff to the atmosphere, but secondly, we're getting rid of the sinks.
Yep. In other words, basically the filters are working and then growing to work more efficiently, thus taking out the carbon dioxide. So people who use that as an argument for global warming, well, if we could cut down on deforestation, we mm-hmm. really can benefit ourselves in the long run. I mean, right. even in the short term, I think that they're saying that plants are doing this within not even a single life cycle or generation. I think they're doing it much sooner.
And when it comes to SUVs, like say I own one, it's great. I mean, I'll tell you the truth right now. I have a Jeep with oversized wheels, and that thing, once I put the oversized wheels on it, you know, I've driven one of the thin ones, and it's kind of scary when the oversized ones, it's stable and it's rock solid, and I absolutely love the thing. The Ford Explorer, it's kind of questionable still, but, you know, the thing is, it's great to kind of cut back on gasoline right there, but what do you think would be better to go ahead and get people to move out of SUVs? Because I got to be honest right there, even the Ford Explorer, dude, it's like I'm driving a small bus.
You know,
absolutely. That's empty wherever I go.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't drive it that much anymore, although it's great when I have to tow something. But what do you see as a good way to get people to actually migrate to smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles?
Well, there is the perception pushed by the automotive industry that bigger is safer.
Mm-hmm.
What we really need to do is come up with smaller cars that have sufficient crashability or energy absorbing ability, and show the public that, look, if you drive this small car, you are just as safe as driving this big car.
Right.
And we need to do that. And we have the engineering and the computers to do it.
Oh, absolutely. So, even my car right there by itself right there is absolutely great. I mean, my DeLorean, you know, the crashability is great, but there's something different about it though. I mean, a lot of people, the reason I like SUVs and trucks as well is, I mean, I've had my truck. I've rear-ended somebody in that truck. You were with me that time.
Yeah.
That's another story. Check the archives at spankwagon.net for that one. You know, I've been rear-ended in my Ford Explorer twice, and the repairs to them are very minuscule. A cab-over-chassis design I like is more durable because I'm someone that keeps vehicles, which a DeLorean is literally just a cab-over-chassis, the same as a truck.
Yes.
I don't like unibody cars because as soon as I get into a mild fender bender, the entire subframe is tricked, and I might as well throw it away.
Yes. All right. Looking at the clock, we're going to have to go ahead and take another break.
You are listening to Spank Wagon Radio.
With our guest, Dr. Bob, and the... I know. I was going to say something witty and went out about the whole Star Trek thing. But
the Trekkie invasion.
The Trekkie invasion. Of
yes,
course,
they're in regalia.
You're wearing a red shirt. You are so
She's expendable.
Screwed. All right. We'll be back in a little bit.
Spank Wagon Radio.
Looking for some place to host your website, or maybe you already have a host and are looking for a better deal? Then check out AnywhereHost.com. AnywhereHost.com offers 24/7 live technical support, a 99.99% network availability guarantee, and with packages starting as low as under $10 a month, you can see why hundreds are making the move to AnywhereHost.com. Visit the website for all the hosting packages available at AnywhereHost.com or call toll-free at 1-888-863-4383. That's 1-888-863-4383.
Jacket. I'm the volume in your fucked up teenage band. A bag of smokes and a six pack. I'm the dreams you had walking down railroad tracks, you and me. Forever. So take
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, we're back.
Like vertebrae.
And you're still listening to the greatest internet radio show ever.
Spank Wagon Radio.
All right. It's you keep wiggling the board. Hold on. We'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
Holy crap.
So we'll make sure you
Since when were you the impatient one? I thought I was always the impatient one.
No.
Okay. Again, I'm your host, Trencher.
I, of course, am the infallible Claude Balls.
And we have a studio full of guests and a lot more things to cover.
Indeed. Yes, many things to cover.
We need to do this now. Can you cue up the music?
Which music?
You
have a dead celebrity?
No. We got mad props to do.
You have mad props. So you want to hear mad props music?
Yeah, we have mad props to
do. I see how this works now. Fine, I'll let you have your way.
Thank you.
I'm in with the out crowd.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is now time to acknowledge every one of you in the chat room who are cool enough to hang out with us for 2 hours on a Friday. God, some people need social. Never mind. What we're going to do is acknowledge you with
Mad Props.
So first, since we got a full chat room, let's go with Anorexic Pillow.
Mad Props.
This is where you come in. They love this. Let's go up with Canada Dude, or excuse me, Canadian Dude, eh?
Like Mad Propsy! Never understand Canada. One country has a completely different leader's face on their currency.
Well, you know.
Chizad. Mad Props!
Foo Foo!
Mad Props!
I overlooked him. Let's give mad props to Diggs.
Mad props.
Reverend Hammer.
Mad props.
Strange Ways.
Mad props.
Toe.
Mad props.
Trekkie, who's here? And Virtual One.
Mad Props.
And that's the Mad Props acknowledging all of our wonderful listeners who are cool enough to hang out with us.
I'm in with the out crowd. I'm in with the out crowd.
All right.
Well, that was quickly over.
Wow.
Well, we do actually have a lot to talk about. Now, next up, you have developed some software.
Oh, yeah.
And what's the name of the software? And what
exactly
is it?
Software is called the SA Toolbox.
Bring it into the mic.
The software is called the SA Toolbox.
SA Toolbox.
SA.
It's just for Latin people. Chicanos.
No.
Okay.
It's for the common man, Claude.
It's for everyone who's in college.
Chicanos are pretty common if you spend enough time in Vegas. Anyone in college. I couldn't resist the punchline. I'm sorry.
Trekkie's going to put it up on the chat board right now.
All right.
You can check it out online and download a demo if you're interested.
What does it do?
What does it do? It allows you to organize any research paper you're doing in a more logical format, to separate each individual task of a research paper into little chunks you can bite off and take care of.
Hmm.
And this allows you to print your essay and print your works cited and your bibliography, and it's a totally integrated system that basically helps you do any homework assignment you've ever been given.
Okay, what's it called one more time?
It's called the Essay Toolbox. So any essay you have to write, you can use this toolbox. I use it for every assignment or speech I'm given now.
Okay, so Essay, E-S-S-A-Y, Toolbox.
Mm-hmm. And you can check it out at www.brandmuffinindustries.com and click on the FileMaker tab.
That's very interesting right here. That's available apparently for both Windows XP and OS X.
Mm-hmm. So check it out. The demo is going to work for the next 23 days, and we're going to talk about what it does.
Please.
Now, what it allows you to do is the first thing is we search online article databases. The Essay Toolbox has 5 drawers, and they're all color-coded. And the research drawer is the purple one at the bottom, and it links you to online article databases like ProQuest and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and you type in some search terms for what you're looking for. And it returns articles that have been written and put in the databases, and they've all been peer-reviewed, so that you know they're good articles. And in the olden days, before you had this software, you had to print them out, and you'd go through, and you'd highlight them, and you'd rip them into piles, and you'd build note cards. And you
I'm having a flashback to hours and hours of EBSCOhost, hours and hours of InfoTrack, hours and hours of just...
InfoTrack.
Just...
You know, I used to actually have an address for that. I wouldn't go to the library, just tell that directly to it.
Yeah, it's just a big mess, and it's inefficient in terms of using your abilities to get it done as quickly as possible.
Okay.
So what you do is you find an article you want, and instead of printing it out and wasting paper, you just copy it into a record into your database.
Okay.
So you have a sources record that has the full text of the article you're reading, or maybe you don't want to read it yet. Just hold on to it and collect all the full text that you intend to read later.
Mm-hmm.
So then you can go through and say, okay, this is the name of the article, this is the guy who wrote it, this is the title, this is the publication, and you put all those in the boxes, and it builds you your works cited, your bibliography reference.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Very cool.
And a lot of times when you're doing these papers, that's the first thing the teacher wants to see. Before he sees anything else, he wants to see you've actually done your research.
Mm-hmm.
So you populate the sources table with 20 sources you found. You build your works cited. You click a button. You print it out. Put your name on it. Put your teacher's name on it. And it's done.
Hmm.
There you go. And it all automatically puts it in alphabetical order and adds all the numbers.
And MLA format. So it follows all the rules your teachers want.
Okay. Now, just got to have to ask this. Is there any APA like format or plugins or anything coming out for the future? Because I know a lot of instructors I've had, they mm-hmm. all love APA more than MLA.
That's very true. We're working on ways where you can select MLA or APA and
okay.
build either one for you.
Very cool.
It kind of replaces your need for NoodleBib. NoodleBib does not have a spell check. So if you spell something wrong on your bibliography, you're going to get marked down for that.
Right.
But this does have a spell check integrated
into it.
Very cool.
Interesting.
So you've got...
Does it also have like a thesaurus and like word check, you know?
Oh, yeah. You just right-click and it'll give you all of that.
Okay.
So you've got all these sources you found, and you're starting to read them, and you need to make virtual highlights or virtual note cards. You say, oh, I like this paragraph. I like this line. Maybe I'll use this in my paper. So instead of writing it on all these note cards and filling up your house full of 3x5 cards,
right.
you create virtual note cards. You just select it and say, make this a note. And it makes these little green boxes next to your blue source.
Okay.
So you can browse all the notes you've created from a certain source.
All right.
So then you've populated about 40 or so different note cards that come from all various sources, and you need to start organizing them. And in the old days, you would take your big stack of note cards and you'd put them into different piles. What you can do is you can create virtual piles called concepts. So you put your notes into concept piles. And okay, this concept has 10 notes attached to it.
Okay.
This concept has a few here. So you can then begin writing each concept body paragraph by looking at the notes you've collected and organizing them, putting them in the right order you want, and then you write each concept separately. Especially when you're knee-deep in one concept and you've written its paragraph and you haven't started the other ones yet. You're not sure what order they're going to go in, so you can put them in any order later.
Okay.
Once they've been written. So you can go back and revise it and move them around at any time. There's little buttons up, down, and moves them around.
Very and cool. If the teacher wants to see all your note cards, you press a button and it prints out all your note cards.
That's right.
There you go. Awesome.
Very interesting.
And this software is available, as you said, for Mac OS X?
Mac and Windows. You can get it at brandmuffinindustries.com. Click on the FileMaker tab. It's sure to make your essay writing life a lot easier. It separates everything into small components for you to work on. I use it for everything I do now.
Very cool.
Teacher, would you use that?
Absolutely.
You really would?
Absolutely. If I actually, last semester, that was pure hell because I was just becoming my first-time dad. Mm-hmm. I was taking one class. But
yes,
it was
since you last saw.
Congratulations. Thank you. One kicker of a class because it was a world-lit class, and I had paper after paper after paper. And that's very hard to keep everything together you have to get up every 20 minutes to go rock your son or feed him or do whatever is necessary. So, definitely could have used this last semester.
Well, that's what you get for having kids so early.
Ah, darn. What, early? No.
And according to the college he's working with, is the number one class that students fail is research papers.
Mm-hmm. English 103 is the research paper. They fail it because they can't handle organizing their work. This puts it right in front of you and says, this is your next step. And
this is entirely written by you?
Yes.
What did you write it in?
I wrote it in a database program called FileMaker Pro.
Okay.
And it starts off with little fields and boxes that hold text, and you can think of that as the skeleton.
Okay.
And then you start to add musculature, which is the functions and the buttons that do things, so basically everything boils down to one click once you're using the musculature.
Yeah. I had to ask because we have a lot of people. I know a lot of the people in our chat room, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are actually programmers for Apple. And,
okay.
And they actually program Apple, PC, any of the Unix variants.
Okay.
Now, how much does it cost? Because I see there's a demo. How much would this cost?
Well, the demo works for the next 30 days or so, and then you can buy a six-month license for, I think it's like $15.
Okay.
That's very reasonable. That's very reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can use it for a while, and if you like it, you can buy the unlimited version, which I think is $50 or something.
And of course, some.
And if it's a hit, it'll end up on Wares.
Yeah, really. you'll be Nutella'd all over the nation and world. one thing actually, I kind of find the licensing interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm an open source guy. I mean, mm-hmm. I find that an interesting licensing structure. I've never thought of that, but it just kind of dawned on me. 6 months. That's perfect for a semester.
That's right.
And you don't need it anymore. You're not downloading and keeping something you don't need.
I have a question for you.
That never dawned on me because everything I either get is either pay the one time mm-hmm. and then you go on forever owning a piece of software that is obsolete within, mm-hmm. we'll say, 20 months.
Right.
You know.
Unless you write books. This is a great program.
Exactly.
Right.
Unless you're an author. So that's cool. You were going to say something?
Yeah. I forgot what I was going to say, actually.
It was that important. So, actually, we were talking during the break, conspiracy theory based on Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we have a lot of interesting opinions and
everyone's pretty information. Everyone's pretty sound with my conspiracy theory, which I've actually stated right after it happened. I believe, of course, that they allowed people to die in Hurricane Katrina because they were poor welfare recipients, and mm-hmm. this way we could save money by not having to feed, clothe, house, or arrest them anymore.
Yes, most of it you are.
Yes. But before we present that as an option, why don't we talk about a few of the data points that tend to hint in that direction?
Okay, please.
One of the which is there is a 448-page Southeast Louisiana Catastrophic Hurricane Plan.
Which actually came out around the same time that they came out with the catastrophic plans for terrorist attack in New York uh-huh. City, earthquake in California. Sorry.
Uh-huh. It was published by a place called IEP, and they hadn't totally finished the report yet. But this was on FEMA's desk mm-hmm. Months before Katrina hit, and it said, if a hurricane hits Louisiana, here's a hypothetical Hurricane Pam. She's a Hurricane 3. Here's the damage she's going to do. The levees are going to fail. Here's what you need to do to keep the maximum number of people alive.
Mm-hmm.
And they threw this book right in the trash did not acknowledge its existence and still have not made it public.
But yet it's pretty well known. I mean, I've heard about it from a lot of different sources.
Right.
You know, I mean, everybody knows that it's out there, but the frustration is that, okay, why do we have this information that no one acted upon? One question I always have to ask about that is, how many of these do they get? How mm-hmm. many, you know, this is the worst thing that could happen in this case, and they get 20 of these a week or a month, you know, and they're expected to go through all of them?
Well, no, this was actually a federally funded project that had been involving for almost 6 years.
Okay.
They knew the levees in New Orleans and actually the whole Biloxi, Mississippi, and that whole area at best could withstand a Category 3 hurricane. So they knew if we were going to exceed it, we had to have a plan to deal with that. And this was a project that had been funded for many years, and it was now into the testing stage of running simulations and seeing what we would need to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 months prior to Hurricane Katrina, the state was involved, the feds were involved, all of the local police agencies were involved. They all went through this test emergency project, and from that they learned, well, we need this, we need this. Mm-hmm. So they actually had the basic footprint of how to respond, and that footprint, granted, it wasn't a finished document.
Sure.
There was only 3 more months to finish it up, mm-hmm. but it was in FEMA's hands, it was in the state hands. Everybody knew that this was a 99% finished document.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't like, well, we were just kind of imagining. It was 99%
right.
finished. Mm-hmm. And when the Katrina was moving in, from a federal level, they ignored it. The state knew it exists. They said, hey, come on, guys. We did this exercise. Let's play the game. And the feds just ignored it. Good old Michael Brown, Mr. Incompetency Bush appointee friend, I don't know anything. I only know how to play with horses.
That's true. They've recently uncovered a lot of emails with him, too. First of all, it was known that after he was suddenly had a spotlight on him, he actually forged his resume so that he would look better as a appointee to
FEMA. Oh, yeah.
And now they have emails out saying that he actually wanted to resign his post as soon as Hurricane Katrina hit because he knew he couldn't handle it. And when he was given briefings as to what the situations not only would be, but actually were live emails and things like that, he just simply responded back with, well, let me know what I need to do here.
One thing to actually point out, he is actually still employed by FEMA.
Yeah, pulling a salary.
As a consultant. So he, as incompetent as he has been, what little he has done is still there.
Oh, well, he's, you know, Bush has got to take care of his political friends, and that's what Michael Brown was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here, and what really gets to me about this is, look, okay, I don't know damn thing about emergency planning, but I have a little bit, or you should have a little bit of common sense. If things are going bad, people need food, people need water. How stupid do you have to be to not figure out people need food and water? And if you listen to some of the people at FEMA, and historically since its inception almost 20 years ago,
sure,
there were a lot of experts at FEMA, and experts were telling Michael Brown, you got to do this, you got to do that. And it was falling on deaf ears. Well, you know, common sense, falling on deaf ears. Wait a minute. There's more going on here if people aren't even making common sense decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this...
Interesting thing to point out, actually. Right after we started dealing with Hurricane Katrina, there was a typhoon in, I want to say it was in Japan.
Yes.
And during that typhoon, not after, during that typhoon, rescue workers were already working on food, water, supplies, and helping out the people who were the victims.
Right.
Okay.
You know, and it's you know, boggles my mind that here we are, a wonderfully industrialized country. We should be, we can't even take care of ourselves like that.
I don't think it's an issue of can or can't. I think it is we can, we chose not to.
Okay. Yes.
Well, I have a question here to throw something else out in the ring. We've had different theories, such as mine, of course, to let the people die because they're a burden,
yes,
which kind of does tie in as well with, you know, the land grab for real estate.
If you look at the property values.
How many more casinos will go in?
Mm-hmm. The property values in New Orleans have just gone crazy. In fact, all of Louisiana is experiencing high growth rates. And what happens is, let's say all these people die or they're drowned and they're washed out to sea. The other thing is they're doing is they're claiming to have lost all the deeds, so they don't know whose house was whose, which makes the land county property. And at that point, the county can decide to give or sell the land to any of their friends at 10 cents on the dollar. You're talking half-acre beachfront property here that people can get for really cheap prices.
Hmm.
You know, if you wash all these poor people out of this beachfront property, you can put up the next Atlantic City.
Yeah, well, that's what they're trying to do down in, you know, down in Biloxi. I mean, a lot of what was damaged in Biloxi was casinos.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know.
Well, what about Florida, though? Because recently, as we've seen with Florida, Florida has been ignored as well, equally as well. Is this something as – are we looking at the same
– Not equally. Well, Florida has a better handle on how to recover
from
a hurricane.
True. But no. Hear me out. There still has been a lot of problems with Florida. Recovery in Florida so far has not been quite what it was, especially with fuel and food shortages for people. Is Florida, are they ignoring it on purpose to make Katrina look better?
I think when you look at the massive problems that still exist along the Gulf course near Louisiana, and then you look at that scale compared to Florida, the media is taking the minor problems in Florida and blowing them up into being huge problems.
Uh-huh.
The reality is what's still going on in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama are still absolutely huge problems.
There are still people who live in, for instance, the Houston Astrodome. They're still on public assistance.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And they're actually the owner, not the Astrodome, excuse me, I was thinking of the Superdome. The actual owners of the Saints are now working on, hey, let's use this as an excuse to get out of, New Orleans. A little bit of sports thing there. So,
well,
I mean, there you got everybody
surprise
bailing.
Myself as well.
Well, you know what's a little bit behind the scenes? Remember recently there was a Supreme Court decision regarding eminent domain for economic development.
And there has been a backlash on that, too. What they're saying right now is the Supreme Court has said the eminent domain item as well. But there's been a backlash as well saying that if eminent domain is used for commercial purposes, for commercial third-party investors that are not public, then they can actually withhold road funds and other federal assistance from states that abuse it. There has been a fail-safe put in place on that recently. of course, it's still a little too late for New Orleans, obviously.
Well, I'll give you some real-life history behind that.
Please.
You know, we're from Illinois, and one of the suburbs there, a bunch of homeowners got together and decided to sell a block of property.
Sure.
Roughly some 25 acres. It's extremely rare. You can't find that near the city.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't just Illinois, but when homeowners got together and sold large tracts, many acres, they mm-hmm. could get 300% of what their property was normally worth.
Because they sold it in that large amount.
Right. So now what this law allows is to the city to go in and say, we want this 25-acre site, and you only get market value, not 300%.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, I thought there were laws against this because, as I've seen on a lot of deeds in here in Clark County for tract homes, it specifically states you may not combine property into a single entity. You see that in a lot of tract homes, you know, to prevent someone from buying a house and then the one next door and then tearing them both down to build a single mansion on the piece of property.
Right, there are local codes that limit that. But, again, that's a one guy with one or two lots. Now, we're talking massive. This is a TIF. This is an economic
right.
development tax area. And if the rich guys get together with the politicians and go, hey, we want this big A site here, condemn all these homes, give these people a few cents on a dollar.
Right.
Once it becomes in the businessman's hands, it goes up 300% in value.
Mm-hmm.
They can't lose. So what
yeah.
the law did is make it easier for rich people to make more money.
Right.
Yeah.
All because of different tax codes. And
if you look at the Wall Street Journal, I believe it was about a week ago, there are some islands off of Florida that were hit in Hurricane Katrina.
Right, right.
They have now gone in there, bought up all of that island property,
mm-hmm.
paid the homeowners roughly $10 million. The tract is now worth $100 million. Because they're going to build multi-level condos where previously were single-family homes.
Right,
and that's what's planned for Bernard Parish.
Now, which is interesting, you know.
That's what's planned for the parish.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
And it's interesting.
Yes. I've not heard that.
The day after Katrina hit New Orleans,
okay.
Look at the Wall Street Journal page, I don't know, 567. There's an investment article about New Orleans.
Interesting. Now, one thing that, you know, in my mind, I'm sitting there going, no, wait a minute. Hit by a massive hurricane in a hurricane-prone area. They want to buy this out and build condos.
It's for the people that simply, well, you know, we're from Vegas. We should understand the, you know, outside investors that don't give a damn about our community.
And we
simply
do.
Waiting to rape our wallets.
Turnberry yes. Place. They condos for everyone to live in. Everybody buys them and turns them into timeshares.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
no one lives in these buildings. We were discussing this earlier
right.
tonight, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, wealthy people buy those, so they have bragging rights. Oh, yeah, I own a home here. I own a home there. They may come to those homes, too. Well, from a tax law point of view, if you spend more than 14 days in that particular thing during the year,
sure.
then you could literally write the whole thing off
yep.
as
right.
an expense.
And yeah. one of the things here as well, now you own property here in Las Vegas.
Yes, we do.
But you're a resident of Chicago.
Yes.
So I'm sure you're very well of your 10% tax hike on your property.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. That's another thing they've tried to do to try to curb this, but it's obviously not working.
Yeah, but we own a home here because we plan to retire here.
Ah.
Yeah, and we knew the
So you have a future investment in this community.
That's correct.
Which is actually
okay.
nice to hear, you know, being from Vegas and, you know, no one's from Vegas and people are only here for, well, I think I actually outlived it, the five-year rule. You know,
yes,
if you're
yes,
here for
yes.
5 years and you move back to wherever you came from
because
you just can't handle it. So.
Yeah, people can't take the lifestyle here, both, you know, physical from the temperature and the environment to the temptations.
Well, you don't have to shovel snow.
You don't have to
shovel heat. Yes, you don't have to shovel heat.
Yeah, I don't have to shovel sand off my driveway in the January.
Snow's not that bad. I was in the worst winter on Ohio history.
You don't know nothing. You guys get it worse because you guys get the lake effect.
Oh, man.
I mean, I'm from Iowa, okay?
Yes.
So when that front comes right down out of Canada and dumps snow and then a wind blows and then just piles it up, you don't know anything. I don't think he's ever mentioned this. He had to call my wife.
Yes.
to ask her, how do I use a snow scraper?
I did not use an ice scraper. I thought it was a lint remover.
He thought it was a lint remover because the rental vehicle he had had
suede seats. I had a Nissan Murano.
Like, oh, my God, what do you mean?
So I got in there and started going, hey, all right, let's try it out. And I was actually scraping my seats down with an ice scraper.
He's never experienced a 6-foot drift of snow.
No, he's never had to deal with ice that, you know, black ice that comes out of nowhere.
I was in my SUV. I was safe. If there was black ice, I wouldn't have known it because SUVs are impervious.
All right. Why don't we go and do this?
I don't think so.
Impervious to what? Why don't we go ahead? Let's pitch every website, pitch your book. We definitely want to make sure that
you have another book coming out, too.
Well aware of this.
Yes.
What's your next book about?
Okay. Well, if you want to take a look at our books, you can see them at www.safety-epa.com.
Or www.ohcs.com. O-E-H-C-S.
Yeah. We'll go ahead. We'll have links on the site for everyone, of course.
Now, Rob, you bring up an interesting question. We're working on another book, and what predicated this book was when we were working on trying to make people more aware about mold standards that exist in other countries. We had the opportunity to look at occupational or exposure limits in
sure.
other countries.
Other countries that do actually have them.
Right. And the United States government, as well as the trade organizations that represent the people are supposed to be protecting the workers, mm-hmm. only tell people in the United States that there are chemical exposure standards for only 600 chemicals.
So you're telling me that the material data safety sheet should be a lot thicker?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
That thing should be a wall in itself from the numbers.
So it should be basically right now, instead of being like a big, thick telephone book, it should be like a small encyclopedia.
Yes.
Set.
Yes.
Set.
Yeah. The rest of the world has chemical exposure standards for over 5,000 chemicals.
Now, I myself am someone who loves obscure stuff like this, obscure to the mainstream. Where would I find one of these for the worldwide standards? Is there a website even? Do you have a link on your website?
Yes. Please? It's called Global Occupational Exposure Limits for over 5,000 specific chemicals.
Okay. Interesting.
Now, so we have the websites. And what was the name of the software that you wrote one more time?
The SA Toolbox.
SA Toolbox. I think we need to start wrapping this up.
The SA Toolbox. And that's available, you said, at BrandMuffinIndustries.com?
Yes. And one more thing I'd like to plug, BrandMuffin Industries and Safety-EPA.com are proud to have Think Stainless Designs do our web developing. You can check out Tiffany's wonderful work at www.thinkstainless.com.
So there
Very
you go.
Everyone loves brushed metal background.
Is our engineer here?
Yeah, I believe
Where's our engineer?
You can tell no one in this room is a WoW player.
Yeah, no one in this room is. All right, folks, it's time to wrap this up, so let's do it.
You got the music?
I got the
music. Oh, the one time you don't have the music ready. Great. Grab your glow sticks, it's a rave.
Ladies and gentlemen, we do thank everybody for listening in, and we do need to thank everybody that allows us to be here. First, want to say thank you to LVRocks.com for giving us the studio space, ExtremeRadioTampa.com, MegaRock-Radio.com, KCHost.net, and RealMusicNetwork.com for being wonderful syndicates all across the United States. Also, a big thank you to podcast.lvrocks.com, where you can download this show and listen to it and re-listen to it on your own.
That's right. You have an iPod? You don't have an iPod.
Oh, you need an iPod. Right.
Well, if you had an iPod, you could go ahead and listen. Or other MP3 players, I'm sure.
Also want to say a big thank you to Friends of Spankwagon, All-Star Felons, Ars Anime, Daily Noise, Subject to Discussion, and VFTP. Again, I'm your host, Trencher.
I am the infallible Claude Balls.
You've been listening to
Spank Wagon Radio.
And we'll be back next week.
Spank Wagon.